Blog Talk Radio.
Ron Edwards, and this is the Don and Ron program coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Our associate, Mr. Allen, will not be with us tonight on this the occasion, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis, Tennessee, at the Lorraine Motel. A lot of discussions going on across the country, and certainly the memory of Dr. King is important, not only to be remembered, but to be respected as it pertains to the things that he was about, the things that he accomplished, and etc. The period in the 1960s was a period of significant and bigger than life individuals, male and female, within the Black America. Early on, we had lost Malcolm X and Medgar Evers and others. We were saying as we came into the early part of 1968 that maybe some level of civility, if you will, would begin to take place in America. But I think that many of us who were young African Americans at that particular point who had already served in the battles of the civil rights movement starting in 1960 for those of us who were moving into our teen and early adulthood and et cetera. And so I could well remember tonight on this program, as we take a look at part one of tonight's program, the actions, the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I can still remember it as if it were this afternoon when the broadcast came over the radio. I was sitting in my automobile. I was working for one of the utility companies here in Minneapolis. I had just returned from the University of Syracuse after matriculating, if you will, in the Alinsky School of Political Science Development and et cetera. I had received both my certificates and degree from the Maxwell School of Political Science, if you will, from Alinsky and et cetera. Was washing cars, actually, but had become vice chair of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission, if you will, and it was an interesting and has continued to be an interesting journey as it pertains to the experience of life. But I can well remember, and chills ran through my entire body, and anger began to flush through my system, if you will. Many of us younger men in those days been trying desperately to maintain the semblance of peace, if you will, peace in our time, not to be confused with Neville Chamberlain at Munich in 1937. But it was difficult. Black churches were being bombed. Black people were being killed, if you will. Police oppression, suppression, obstruction, and et cetera was a common activity each and every day in the United States of America, but we still wanted to believe that Dr. King was preaching nonviolence in the tradition of Gandhi and India, if you will, and later, upon his release from Robben Island, Nelson Mandela, and condolences to our black brothers in South Africa, Nelson Mandela's wife and companion, quietly 2 days ago in South Africa, and our condolences as a black American, to our black South African and white South African brothers and sisters. These people were legends. They were absolute legends and fought the good battle, a tremendous battle, if you will. We were reflecting on a statement in this morning's edition of our major newspaper here in the state of Minnesota, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which quoted some of us who still remember, if you will, and still can function with regards to that tragic day, that tragic evening, about 6 o'clock in the evening, if you will, on April 4th, 1968. William English, a longtime activist in this community, a man who had just arrived here about a year and a half before, had taken up responsibilities. Later, he was to become one of the best-known affirmative action officers in corporate America, working for then the Control Data Corporation, if you will. We used to have many conversations with Bill English and other men of our quote-unquote generation about, would we be able to turn the corner? Could we make it? Would the forces of evil, nullification, reversal, and et cetera, allow us to have an opportunity for a place at the table, if you will, and would allow our children and grandchildren and their children and grandchildren to live out the dream, to carry out the dream, to enjoy the fruits of the dream, if you will. And there was much discussion amongst us that we were hoping that would happen. But that early evening, that shot that was fired from a window of a building across the courtyard from the balcony of the Lorraine Hotel, Lorraine Motel, where Martin Luther King Jr. and a couple of other important African Americans were standing. As he was hit with a well-armed and well-fired shot, when I say well-armed, I'm talking in terms of the kind of ammunition that was used, a high-powered rifle, which basically blew part of the side of his face away, if you will. And so that night here in Minneapolis and St. Paul and in many, many American cities and towns and enclaves, African Americans, joined by some others of color, if you will, put on display the anger, the frustration, the sense of denial for the opportunity, as we said just minutes ago, to enjoy that which was so enjoyed by those who brought us here in bondage, in slavery, and etc. Many discussions went on for the days following that, if you will. Violence, flames licked across the major cities of America. Some thought that Washington, D.C. was going to be burnt to the ground. Federal troops were called in, if you will, National Guard in other places, federal troops in other places, as Black America playing its anger, its frustration, its sense of betrayal, if you will. Minneapolis, though we suffered a tragic death of a young 25-year-old white man killed on Humboldt Avenue North on the 1000 block of Humboldt Avenue North in North Minneapolis, a man by the name of Murphy, his name reflected in this morning's edition of the major newspaper here, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, a man at around 6:20, 6:25 that night on his way to purchase milk for his young baby back at his home with his young wife and his child. My brother by the name of Clarence Underwood, who we all knew, we had grown up with, a man who was serious, if you will, about his politics, serious about his vision for the future of the Negro, the sons and daughters of the African, came out of his home, and he actually incorrectly said They killed my king. They killed my king. My king is dead. And fired a single shot into the chest of this innocent young 25-year-old white man on his way to purchase a carton of milk from the little convenience store there on Plymouth Avenue. In many regards, it was probably to Murphy here in Minneapolis that night, though there were raging gun battles that were taking place across the city, Minneapolis and St. Paul. We did not appear to suffer any additional fatalities, though people were wounded, if you will. Folks tend to not want to remember that, or they just don't remember, if you will. You got to remember, it was 50 years ago. Not only do lives fade and disappear, but memories and recollections do the same. But as a chairman of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission, just newly founded after 6 years of battling with the forces of political institutions and et cetera, I was called to a meeting at 1:30 a.m. in the morning at City Hall by the chairman of the Civil Rights Commission, the W. Smith, Bill Smith, as he was known to many, later to become the Reverend W.W. Smith, if you will, a man of great vision, great writer, if you will, a man who wrote many articles, if you will, died before his time, but a man who, like many of us, hoped that there would be, quote-unquote, an awakening, if you will, that there would be an appropriate judgment, that the sons and daughters of the African had clearly earned the right to be able to live peace and harmony and not be the targets and the victims. But the mean-spirited disposition of our slave masters and those who had brought us here in bondage and in chains, etc. And so by 7 or 8 o'clock that morning, the morning of the 5th of April, 1968, there was a desperate attempt to try to keep the lid, as we said in this morning's edition of Minneapolis Star Tribune, keep a lid on this city, hope that there would not be a significant number of casualties and fatalities and et cetera. Corporate Minneapolis and St. Paul worked with the African-American community and others of a like mind and a sense of compassion, if you will, and with honor. General Mills Company chartered a DC-8 aircraft, if you will, and people such as Josie Johnson, the Curtis Shivers, the number two man at the Minneapolis, at that time called Minneapolis Spokesman, St. Paul Recorder, he wife of the editor and the publisher of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, John Coles, his wife, Sage Coles, who had also, was also serving on the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission with myself and Reverend Smith and others, if you will, boarded an airplane and flew from here to Atlanta, Georgia, disembarking that early morning, being bused, if you will, to march and then later to the church where the services, which I will never forget, King Jr., were held. We were still a nation that had not yet let out that breath. We just were not sure. Radical neo-Nazi forces in the United States were calling for, quote-unquote, a, quote, purge of the Negro in America, taking advantage of the sense of outrage and et cetera, but somewhere or another, the United States of America, and particularly Black America and other communities of color, held together. And so we are one who lived. We did not get our information on this one out of a book, if you will, written by a white publishing firm and a white author and et cetera. We lived it. We were here in the streets of this city. We had seen confrontations, by the way, for those that really have studied the history of our city, if you will, because in the years 1966, 67, 68, even going back as far as 1964, there had been violence, there had been conflict along Plymouth Avenue and along Lake Street, if you will, in South Minneapolis, et cetera. There had been problems along Rondo in St. Paul. In fact, out of the conflict and a major gun battle between young African Americans and St. Paul police after a serious confrontation at what was then called Stem Hall in the old St. Paul Auditorium, if you will, later named Roy Wilkins Auditorium, if you will. Yes, a major gun battle in and around the area of Fisk and Selby in the city of St. Paul as young Negroes police exchanged gunfire. But out of that, corporate St. Paul stepped up with a man, a young man by the name of Theodore Ham, heir to the Ham Brewing fortune, and et cetera, stepped forward, began to work with the Hickman brothers, a man who later became a city councilman, and before that was the commissioner of the Department of Human Rights, a man by the name of Bill Wilson, Little Bill Wilson, as they call him, and myself. We were the original incorporators of that organization, if you will, the Inner City Youth League, which continued to exist and serve the African-American community of St. Paul for many, 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 many years. Much of these things are periodically maybe touched on, and then 10 or 12 or 15 years go by and nothing more is said. People come in to our city, if you will, thinking that they understand what has been the history here. This history goes back a long ways, my friends. It goes way all the way back to a black surveyor by the name of Bongo, who was employed by the Hudson Bay Company, if you will. A man born, his parents born in AE, born in Quebec, if you will, a powerful man. A man loved and endeared by the indigenous people of northern Minnesota. A man who was a surveyor. In other words, he knew how to conduct mathematical examinations and et cetera and make boundaries and borders and lines and et cetera, all of this a part of the history that so frequently is denied, not only here in Minnesota, but across the United States, if you will. We have nothing approaching the institutions that we need to have that will allow our young people to know that there is just more than what they are being spoon-fed, if you will. There is a rich history of the sons and daughters of the African. And I remember many conversations in the weeks after the killing, of the murder, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In fact, within a couple of weeks, the Hickman brothers and again Bill Wilson and yours truly were approached by a representative of the Humphrey campaign, Hubert Humphrey, United States Senator, then Vice President of the United States of America, was running in 1968 for the presidency of the United States. And we were asked to commit ourselves to a 11-day being weighed between Hubert Humphrey and Eugene McCarthy. And young man by the name of Bobby Kennedy from Massachusetts, if you will, himself later assassinated in 1968. 1968 was really a tragic year. It was a pivotal year for the United States of America, if you will, and in many respects it set back the movement and the sense of enthusiasm that so many African Americans, young and old, had with regards that we were about to at least turn the corner a little over 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, et cetera. How I remember so much reflection and identification of the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 the end of the so-called Civil War of 1865. The Negro being allowed within a couple of years to have representation in the Congress of the United States, both in the Senate and the House. And that continued for a short period of time until the initiation of the Black Codes. And yet by 1901, there was not a single African-American or Negro in the Congress of the United States of America. We had been purged. Our people had been purged. Our dreams had been purged. We started hearing a word called segregation, a word that was as commensurate with slavery as slavery was with segregation. We watched American cities, if you will, be segregated. We watched not only colored and white water fountains and et cetera, we watched restaurants, hotels, and et cetera. Right here in our own beloved Shangri-La, it was not until 1959 when a white hotel owner by the name of Robert Short, the owner of a number of very large hotels, but also a man who had just purchased the then Minneapolis Lakers, now the Los Angeles Lakers, that was about to move from Minneapolis to the paradises of Southern California. But we well remember it was Robert Short who opened up and stopped the discrimination and segregation and the denial in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul of hotels to deny African Americans or Negroes accommodations, equal accommodations, and et cetera, if you will. These are all a part of the histories. And so during those days following the assassination, the murder of Martin Luther King Jr., there was also much speculation about how that whole situation was handled in Memphis, if you will, and other places. And in the theory of a couple years prior, Lee Harvey Oswald, of course, who was conveniently shot and killed in the hallway in the Dallas Public Safety Building, forever sealing his mouth by a man named Jack Ruby, to tell if he had been a part, he, Lee Harvey Oswald, had been a part of a conspiracy to murder, to assassinate John F. Kennedy, if you will. Well, in the case of Martin Luther King Jr., there was much feeling, much discussion and much suspicion that there was clearly more than, quote unquote, one man, if you will. A man who had such connections and ties that after he had allegedly fired the shot from the window of the building across from the balcony where Dr. Martin Luther King and others stood, if you will, that James Earl Ray was able to and go get in his little white Mustang, if you will, and to speed out of Memphis with the Memphis police and others saying that a white Mustang had been seen going south towards the Mississippi line, if you will. Of course, later, after James Earl Ray was arrested at Heathrow Airport a couple of months later by British intelligence and British customs, if you will, and ultimately deported back, or extradited, really, back to the United States of America. But James Earl Ray held to his position, and I always thought that he would be able to escape, but he was tricked. And at one point, while incarcerated in the state penitentiary in Tennessee, if you remember, for those of you who are true historians, James Earl Ray thought he was tricking and escaping, had gotten away from his guard, almost was scalded to death. People tend to forget that narrative, but it was a sobering experience for James Earl Ray because he realized there were powerful forces that wanted him dead, if you will. And of course, he died, quote unquote, what was said to be a natural death in the penitentiary there in Tennessee. But there was no special commission, really, if you will, that was appointed to take a look at the allegations and the suspicions that there were many others who were involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., including including the head of the FBI, the legendary J. Edgar Hoover, a man who hated King, hated black people, in fact. I can well remember the only two African-American or Negro congressmen in the Congress of the United Congress to impanel a special commission to take a look at the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. This country was having trouble recovering from the information that had been forthcoming in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And, of course, within that period of time also, John F. Kennedy's brother, Bobby Kennedy, shot and killed in a kitchen at a major hotel in Los Angeles, California. We had just, in fact, left California about a week and a half before that assassination. There were things that we saw as a group of young African-Americans who had come to California as a part of the Humphrey presidential advance team, if you will. But that's a story for another time, other circumstances. But there is interesting documentation in the hands of this commentator, if you will, in regard to what was really happening to be and later proved to be preparation for the assassination of Robert Kennedy at that hotel in Los Angeles, California. But rest assured, my friends, and for those that were not even born yet, if you will, who are not even close to their 50th birthday or et cetera, there was much discussion for a long time amongst the sons and daughters of the African about, quote-unquote, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. He was a man who, as a part of his battle, had his ups and downs, if you will. There were moments of greatness, if you will, applause, and et cetera. And then the forces of nullification and reversal would be able to show their power and create situations that, quote-unquote, brought Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Into ill repute and questions about his motives and his intentions, et cetera. A number of years earlier, the late and also beloved Malcolm X had warned Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. of allegedly the level of treachery that existed in this country and the level of hatred of the Negro race and et cetera. Malcolm would always tell people that that pilgrimage that he made to Mecca, where he had a chance to see and understand, and he brought that back to the United States of America, and it became a hallmark of his changing philosophy on how to approach this battle against racism in the United States of America. Of course, it cost him his life. It cost Martin Luther King Jr., as it cost Medgar Evers, as it cost many lesser, quote-unquote, names, but not lesser individuals or human beings who were a part and had been a part of the great struggle just to salvage, if you will, the dreams of the sons and daughters of the African, if you will. And so again, as we move into the last minutes of this program, we remind ourselves how blessed we are, those of us who are still here but who were living and breathing and who were in the battle, if you will, for equality and freedom and et cetera, that we saw firsthand. We didn't have anybody write a narrative for us. We saw it. We lived it. I am not at liberty to discuss on a public platform the actual discussions and some of the actions that some people wanted to take with regards to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Folks were beginning to say that with what had happened to Malcolm X, what had happened to the four little girls at the church in Birmingham, Alabama, what had happened to numerous other leaders in their respective community, their homes bombed, disappearing, and et cetera, you know, that enough was enough. There were some who realized that black America was not ready for the final battle, if you know what I mean, for there were very powerful forces in this country that dreamed of the opportunity to render mayhem and genocide down upon the African-American people, if you will. There were serious discussions, very, very serious discussions that took place. As we said before, here in the city of Minneapolis, it was a combination of young African-Americans, if you will, and other supporters of color, but primarily young African-Americans, supported by their elders, if you will, who had given guidance, knowledge, wisdom, substance, if you will, about the importance of measuring. And be very clear on what it was that you were measuring as it pertains to what actions you would take to revenge those actions in America. Other than the indigenous people of this continent, if you will, our brothers who are referred to as Native Americans, that only they have suffered more indignities and outrages than the sons and daughters of the African slave brought to this country in chains and bondage and etc. One of the things that we would say on this program tonight, on this, the 50th anniversary of the death, of the departure of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., praise ourselves as Black people, of our tenaciousness and the guidance that was given to us, particularly by Black women, by the mothers of the African-American race. It was they that kept us focused, if you will. I know for a fact that that evening that I sat in my automobile and heard the broadcast that Martin Luther King Jr. had been killed in Memphis, Tennessee, it was a pivotal moment, because if it were not for me hearing the voice of my grandmother, who was still alive, living in Kansas City with her family and her daughters and etc., but for some reason or another, her voice came to me and told me and nurtured me in thinking through what it is and what it was, that anger that pulsated through my body, the sense of outrage that I felt, the sense of some hopelessness was now the order of the day. Some of us are blessed, others unfortunately are not, with regards to decision making and how it is that you embrace that which is a part of your spiritual being and helping you to be guided and to have an understanding of the importance of that which you have been put here to carry out in battle for the survival of the African-American race, if you will. We are resourceful people. We, the sons and daughters of the African. And in many regards, tonight, wherever you may be listening to this broadcast, give yourself a congratulations. Not with a sense of arrogance or et cetera, but with a sense of understanding the importance of survival. But also within that context, fight for your race and for yourselves and for your loved ones. What the next 50 years will bring, only the Almighty will probably know. In some situations tonight, there are those who are depressed and having despair with regards to the current situation in the government and with people like Donald Trump and others, if you will. But we have been here before, my friends. Again, as the sons and daughters of the African. And we have survived. We have prevailed. And so let us keep that in mind tonight as we draw to the conclusion of that day, which represents the 50th anniversary. And to people like a William English and a Josie Johnson who are still with us, we must say thank you. Thank you for the battle that you have waged. Though there may be occasions that we have differed in the spirit of, quote unquote, our points of view, the fact of the matter is that we have continued to carry on the battle. That is what is important. The sons and the daughters of the African never, ever give up the battle for survival, for the future of those that are most important to us. And in this case, that is certainly our children, if you will. As we move into the last 25 minutes of tonight's program from here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, as we said earlier, our associate, Mr. Allen, will not be with us. Hopefully, he'll be returning next week. But we must offer our condolences to a African-American family here in our beloved community whose son's life was taken last night on the north side of Minneapolis on the 800 block of Elwood, if you will, just in the vicinity of Zion Baptist Church, one of the oldest African-American churches in the state of Minnesota. A young man was born to Tyrone Williams, if you will, to his mothers, his sisters, his relatives, and et cetera. Condolences from a community that has been stunned by his murder at the hands, at this point, people known or unknown, depending on how one functions, if you will. A lot of pressure has been applied all day today. The mayor, chief of police, who is an African-American, and others have had impressed upon them by activists and those that worked with young Mr. Williams that his death, quote-unquote, and they do not talk about revenge, as best I know it. They talk about the pursuit of justice, and we have a great need for that. I was reviewing, as I was preparing program tonight and the second half of this program, taking a look at the impending actions that are taking place in regards to a young man by the name of Terrence Terrell, if you will. We only pause because Mr. Franklin, the individual in question, his family. And it is important tonight for those of you that are tuned in, if you will, that you take the occasion to reflect back 5 years ago. And to our listening audience across the world, if you will, in the United States and et cetera, for 5 years, the Franklin family has battled, just as the Williams family tonight are reflecting and demanding quick and swift justice. After the events of May 10th, 2013, the Franklin family was doing the same. People were talking in terms of a quick resolution, if you will, that the county attorney, same county attorney that just filed third-degree murder charges and manslaughter against a black officer by the name of Muhammad Nord, but we've talked about that on these programs and have stayed the course. But I encourage those who like to play with the computers and et cetera to go back and take a look at our website and take a look at four consecutive articles that we wrote after the death of Mr. Franklin, of T.T. Franklin, as we called him, if you will. We wrote these articles on the 22nd of May and the 29th of May 2013, and on June 12th, June 19th of 2013, we raised over 40 questions. Even in the first narrative, we talked in terms of what was happening in this city of ours, if you will, and in the matter of Terrence Franklin's death by police, a five-year legal battle drawing to an end. There must be congratulations and certainly respect and appreciation to the attorneys of record, particularly an attorney by the name of Patton, Michael Patton, if you will, who has fought this battle. And as we have reported over the last couple of programs, has uncovered a web of conspiracy, has uncovered documentation, but more importantly, as the courts insist on evidence of the brutal manner in which Terrence Franklin was brutally assassinated, murdered in that basement in South Minneapolis. There are probably some of us that maybe don't want to even remember, but I'm going to do this for you because some of the residents in and about this particular house where Mr. Franklin ran in an attempt to save himself, and et cetera, 2717 Bryant Avenue South, for those that sometimes have forced amnesia and et cetera, if you will. In our article, which will appear on the 12th day of April next week, we make it a point to also let you know that a settlement conference has been suggested and agreed to more by the city attorney in the city of Minneapolis than by the attorneys for the Franklin family. This is a case in which the major white fourth estate, if you will, the media has been extremely silent, if you will, but we would again call you to those four articles written in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder in May of June of 2013 to see this pattern in practice that has been going on for far too long in this so-called enclave of liberalism, etc. There are observations and et cetera that we made in those articles, in those four articles in the African American, the oldest African American newspaper where we still have a column in the state of Minnesota, founded by the late and legendary Cecil Newman. Terrence Jarrell Franklin was a young man who, number one, did not deserve to die, but he damn sure did not die in the brutal manner in which he was killed. He was attacked first by a police dog by the name of Nash, if you will, a 79-pound animal, fully engaged, if you will, in biting and tearing at Mr. Franklin's flesh, biting him in his arms, necks, his testicles, if you will, rendering him almost unconscious then, and then he was pulled to his feet and he was hit. Mr. Franklin was hit with flashlight and with fist and et cetera. It's all. As we go into the final 20 minutes of tonight's program, let me indicate that everything that we're saying to you on this program tonight in the case of T.T. Franklin is in the documents filed by the attorneys for the Franklin family in a case that is now on its way to the United States Supreme Court. And in many respects, this community, black, white, or whatever, have been kept absolutely in the dark. There has been no media coverage, no electronic, if you will, no print, if you will, no nothing other than, I have to say, this commentator, who is also a columnist for the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, that we were puzzled for a long time about the silence until we were asked to review the documents, the depositions, the arguments, and the conclusions that had been forwarded and presented by Mr. Patton and his law firm. Right is right. And though we would probably like to have thought that maybe a black attorney and et cetera would have been in the forefront of the tradition of Thurgood Marshall, you know, Johnny Cochran and others, the fact of the matter is that as a white attorney who has carried on this battle for 5 years, my friends, 5 years. Let us give you a quick narrative in the last 15 minutes of tonight's program. On November 10th of 2016, just 2 days after the so-called upset election of Donald Trump to become 45th president of the United States of America, masterminded by his good friend and companion, Vladimir Putin, head of the Russian Federation, and probably the second most powerful individual in the world as we speak behind, quote-unquote, the Xi Jinping, the president for life of Mother China, if you will. But on November 10th, 2016, Donovan Frank of the United States District Court for the Federal District of Minnesota handed down a ruling that in the matter of Franklin versus the city of Minneapolis and the following individuals, a right to go to trial had been shown to the court. And Judge Frank ultimately gave that authorization again on November 10th, 2016. Now, understanding that this case had been reviewed in 2013 by the same individual who is a county attorney here in the Hennepin County, who found no probable cause to charge, indict, or do anything else to the five police officers of the SWAT team. But here's another piece that some of you need to know. The Star Tribune and other publications in this state knew and yet never reported in a direct violation and contravention of the laws of ethical journalism that there were other individuals, law enforcement, that night, that afternoon, including the person who is now identified in the document as the person that took DNA and et cetera from the body of Terrence Franklin, deceased by that time, his head blown apart, if you will, shot 10 times, if you will. In fact, many of you are not aware how many times he was actually shot. In fact, forensic examinations, experts indicate that, interesting enough, that Terrence Franklin was shot right under the right armpit, if you will. Again, these documents, this information in the files of documents now being looked at by the United States Supreme Court to make a determination if they will allow this case to go ahead. And let me tell you the situation the city of Minneapolis has gotten itself into that is not being shared with you. If the Supreme Court should decide not to hear the case, then it automatically goes back to the trial judge, the federal judge, Donovan Frank, who has already ruled that this case must go to trial, that the public will have a right to know. And so one of the things clearly discovered by Mr. Patton and his team, by some source that broke, that turned over, or as they like to say nowadays, he was turned, by clearly one of those officers who wasn't able to stomach what it was that he saw happen in that basement. A dog, 79-pound German Shepherd named Nash, tearing this black man apart as he was being beaten, if you will. In fact, his beating was so severe that some of his dreadlocks were actually pulled out of his head, if you will. I'm talking about his natural dreadlocks. And then shot in and under the arm. But here's what many of you will be surprised of, that is in filings. And there are many important entities in this city of Minneapolis that have known this for a long time, that though he was probably in the process of beginning to die, if you will, based on being shot by Officer Peterson. This is Officer Peterson's own testimony, his deposition, shooting him in under his armpit on the right side of his body. Again, this is their information. But for some reason or another, the officers drug this young African-American into a small laundry room and closed the door, and then other shots were fired, and that's when they blew his head off, really. I mean, technically, they blew his head apart. They shot him at least 7 to 8 other times, like, as we said earlier, a total of 10 shots fired into Mr. Franklin's body. In fact, the owner of the home of Mr. Bickle actually told some of his neighbors in the days following the death of Terrence Franklin that he had never seen so much blood as he saw in his laundry room. Speckles of blood all over the walls, patches of blood all over the wall, the room, the floor soaked Terrence Franklin. And yet that information was kept from the general public by important institutions in our beloved Shangri-La, our beloved city, if you will. They had known for 5 years that this employee of the Department of Corrections, known as DOC Dave, if you will, his name is in the documents, if you will, man who had a reputation of being a skip chaser, in other words, tracking down people that were on the run and et cetera, being legendary. But it is to read his deposition and the testimony of DOC Dave, if you will, as he tried to explain, quote unquote, his role in putting the DNA of Terrence Franklin on the barrel of that MP5. We have given accurate time, as far as we are concerned, with regards to hoping that people would step up, civil rights leadership and et cetera, who were talking about what they were going to do during those quote-unquote very volatile days in May of 2013. Again, Terrence Franklin was killed on the 10th day of May in the year of our Lord, 2013. Only now, waiting on a decision by the United States Supreme Court, which would probably be made the first week or second week in October of this year, that family continues to wait. I doubt very much, my friend, that the city of Minneapolis is prepared to pay the kind of damages that would be forthcoming, but there is then that danger that once this case goes to trial, that people are required to come in and to testify under oath. Because of the tensions in this city as we speak, because of the way that Mohammed Nord was handled in opposite position in the killing of Jamar Clark, and in the killing of doing his tenure as attorney, as county attorney, of many. You know, in closing, there are many of you who will know some of these names that we will provide to you, if you will. It's a honor roll. It's a roll call of those young African Americans who in the last 10 years have been killed by police in the city. One of them was a up-and-coming young African-American disc jockey. For a long time, we thought that the radio station in which his name was Quincy Smith. There are some of you out there that I know for a fact knew him, had great admiration for him. He was tragically gunned down in the middle of the street in North Minneapolis by a police officer who knew who he was and knew the reasons that he needed to kill Quincy Smith that night on what was a domestic call, because Mr. Smith had filed a lawsuit against this officer and the Minneapolis Police Department and the city of Minneapolis. How quickly we attempt to, again, I encourage you, access our website, the MinneapolisStory.com or Minneapolis, the one word, Minneapolis Story, and a total word, .com. we welcome you to take a look at those articles that we wrote. And we have written additional articles both before and after as it pertains to what has happened to African Americans. For those of you that talked in terms of your friend, Quincy Smith, if you will, his mother, a nurse at Lucy Laney Grade School in North Minneapolis, yes, I hope you very hard to forget or pretend that you forget, and et cetera. But as we come to the conclusion and the close of tonight's program from here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, we think that the memory and the legacy of these young men and women who have been killed, if you will, while in police custody and et cetera, that they have earned the right to have their loved ones or a community. Again, we repeat, a community. Pursue justice for them, if you will. Over the next couple of weeks, if we have people that are really interested in the many victims, Sal Saron Scott, if you will, how many of you did not even know about him? Shot to death right there on 7th Street next to the, though it was not built then, the MTC garage. The top of his skull blown off as a police officer put a shotgun right behind his left ear, pulled the trigger. One of the most horrifying things that you ever want to see. Actually blew the top of his skull across the hood of the police car. An interesting group of individual officers who were involved in that. Nothing ever happened. A detective back in those days, the old guy was tough and he was crusty, but he knew what he was doing. His name was Russ Kruger. Russ Kruger determined the letter that was sent to the Minneapolis Police Department about what happened that night that Sal Saron Scott's head was blown apart. If you're interested, send us a signal, and we'll review with you at least 10 to 12 cases of young African Americans that have been killed under mysterious circumstances in this city just in the last decade and a half. Stay strong, Black America. Stay strong, Black Twin Cities. And remember the expressions and the statements of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and the others, that you must earn the right to stand tall and to stand against the forces of opposition, more importantly, suppression and repression. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening to us. Hopefully our associate will be back next week. Phone lines will be open. I'm Ron Edwards, coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. This is the Don and Ron program, a program committed to telling the truth and to prodding the conscience of the African-American community. God save you, and good night.